obviously we'll come to your UiPath story, and this is not going to be about UiPath, but we'll come to that. But before we come to that, can you tell us a bit about your background before prior to UiPath?
Sure. Hi everyone. Nice to be here, and thank you for having me. And before I start, first event where I'm not presented as ex-chief people officer of UiPath. So yay, you know, 2.5 years into it. Good. Although I cherish the experience and it's been amazing. Prior to that, my background is in software engineering. I started out my career with having my own company, doing small stuff, drove that into a fence in about 3 years, had to get a real job, worked in a software development company for about 10 years on telecom projects. So I was an embedded software engineer, working for some large names in the industry. Then, as you all probably know and see in the economy today, the kind of the semiconductor industry collapsed, except for, you know, China and Korea and Japan. So, you know, pretty much everywhere across Europe, we were left looking for options in this field. So I went more into, let's say, product management, and I quickly realized there was a huge problem with kind of talent retention, talent attraction on the technical side. Then had an opportunity to do something about it, was convinced by a good friend to take over a startup in the space. That's what was called Skill Value, that was doing technical assessment, kind of mapping out technical talent across Europe and doing technical recruitment. And that's how I got to know UiPath. I was actually a CEO of this company for 3 years, and one of our customers was UiPath. Got to know the company, saw they had, you know, a challenge in terms of people's strategy, talked to the founders, asked them if they want some help. They said yes. You know, 3 years later, we were 3,000. Yeah, so that's kind of the way it played out.
Thanks. And you are the chief people officer of UiPath, and during your time, UiPath grew 10x year over year on every metric imaginable, whether that's revenue, valuation, number of people, etc. How did it feel to be in that ever-changing dynamics as a chief people officer?
As a chief people officer, it felt exhausting. As a person who's contributing to the project, it's obviously exhilarating because you get an adrenaline rush every 6, 7, 8 months or so. There's something super new and super exciting that was going on. I mean, it was extremely stressful. It was very tiring, but there were constant reasons for celebration, and that gives you the energy to go on. Like, I remember I officially joined in beginning of 2017. We had the Series A happening in the space of, I don't know, kind of a couple of months after I joined, and that changed the game. Then another 3, 4 months into that, we had our first large American customer, which was Walmart, sign six-figure deal in the higher range of the six-figure deals. And I don't think it was even 3 or 4 weeks later, we had the second large US customer, PepsiCo, do the same thing. So, this is just the first 6 months, you know? So this kind of stuff keeps happening and it keeps going, and it gives you energy to go on, but it was exhausting. And one of the things that I failed at, or that I didn't do very well as the chief people officer, was that I didn't build my team early on fast enough. I definitely did not realize how fast things were moving for UiPath. I mean, I did realize, I just didn't think the weight or the pressure on kind of the corporate functions like HR, like finance, like marketing would increase so fast, so much so fast, and it did, right? So. Bad Marius.
I don't know why this is doing that. I mean, in companies, people say like hire slow, fire fast, hire slow, fire fast. It's an easy thing to say, but in a company where it's growing 10x, you have to definitely hire fast. You don't have the leverage to hire slow, but then you can't fire fast because it would change the whole culture of the company. So it becomes hire fast, fire slow, which is the worst thing that can happen. How did you think around that? And were other departments hiring fast and scaling their teams while you were failing to scale your team?
So short answer is yes. There were people doing a better job at this. And I quickly realized the importance of, you know, leaders coming from other businesses who had gone through, well, not the same thing, because it's hard to go through the exact same thing, but who had gone through similar experiences, right? And as soon as I got the opportunity, I started learning from them. Right, and they were, you know, nice enough people that they were willing to share with, you know, this handful of Romanians who are leaders in the company and who were kind of growing in at the same time as UiPath. But this didn't become, or I can't really say in UiPath, we always liked to say like we were hire fast, fire fast. I think the right answer is that every leader kind of had a very strong imprint on their own team and on their own way of doing things. And I do think there were some leaders who were hiring fast and firing fast, and some of them who were doing it maybe the hiring a bit slower, like my case, the firing a bit faster, also my case. And there were, you know, that we had, I think, all types of leaders ultimately in the company. When, you know, when you're at 3,000 people, you've got a layer of 120 people or so who have executive or sort of immediately below the executive responsibilities and who have to think about stuff like that. And we seem to have had all kinds of flavors in that.
And this becomes a problem for a lot of the startups that are growing from Central Eastern Europe, where you have to launch overseas offices early on. You have to have a London office, New York office, SF office, where your technology team is in Warsaw, Romania, Istanbul, wherever. Under your watch as a chief people officer, the company grew from about 100 people to 3,000 people and to 25 offices. How did you guys sustain the culture? Because it's always tough for an entrepreneur to be able to sustain the culture in 2 offices, let alone in 25 offices.
I can tell you what my approach to it was. And my approach to it has always been, and it still is with the companies I'm working today and that I'm advising today, is that accept the fact that the culture is going to evolve. You're not going to be able to keep the culture intact. And this idea of culture doesn't change is a myth. The moment you allow people with a diverse way of thinking through the door, what you want is to make your culture evolve, to make it better, right? To enrich your culture with, you know, behaviors, symbols. Or you're not going to change the fundamental beliefs of people. That's something that's not going to change. So if we talk about that, and you have a set of fundamental beliefs, right, as a founder, as a core team, you're probably not going to be able to operate much change on those. But there's a lot of other stuff you can enrich. And what happened in UiPath was that I think we were all so hungry to learn and so hungry to make this work. You know, having heard, I think most of us in the initial 100 people had heard from multiple sources that this could never work, and with logical arguments, right? Why you could never scale a company out of Romania. So, but I guess the hunger to make it work and to learn from others who had made it work was so large that we allowed, not for the culture to be changed, but for us to learn from other people. And it's, you know, it's a blend. It's people learning from each other. This is what happens all the time. So if you're running or you're in a startup right now and you have colleagues who may feel, you know, a little bit out of place, remember what your first week or month or day or whatever was in the company that you just joined, or maybe in a previous company, right? There's no culture fit that will make a person feel at home on, you know, day zero or day minus one. That doesn't exist. It's like, we're human beings. We're wired in a certain way. People walk in through the door, right? And they have emotion. They have anxiety. They have expectations for what's going to happen in this new adventure. And if you take all of that stuff and you package it and you bash someone on like their first week, like, oh, you're not a culture fit or something like that, or they don't feel welcome, right, in your organization, because you want to conserve this kind of notion of culture that you have, then you're doing your hiring wrong. Again, it's not about keeping the culture intact. It's about enriching your culture and welcoming people. I feel like I've talked a lot.
This was perfect. And I hear that a lot from entrepreneurs, by the way, because like different departments, different offices, different time zones, you can't have a unilateral, just one size fits all culture. But there should be a couple things that you shouldn't compromise on that has to be in every single location or department. One thing that I hear is passion, like that passion has to be there and that they don't compromise on the passion element within culture. And UiPath has been a milestone, not for Romania, not for Central Eastern Europe, but for all emerging markets around the globe. And I'm saying that because it was the first time that there can be a software company coming out of an emerging market, not become a decacorn, but also be able to IPO in the US as a decacorn. Have you seen the change in external perspectives along the way as the company grew?
There's a lot of expectation in your question, which I am not going to fulfill in any way, unfortunately. I've never felt more Romanian than European, or more European than global. Wherever I spent time on this planet, I felt at home. I love working with people. I love spending time with them. I love, you know, cherishing their local cultures and identities and spending time with them. I've lived in France. I've spent a lot of time in the UK, in Germany, in the United States, in India, and this is prior to UiPath. And then, you know, even more. I know a lot of people say there are perceptions and misconceptions and preconceived ideas, and there probably are, and I'm not going to deny that. I was not exposed to that. I feel maybe I'm lucky. Maybe I'm privileged. But I was not exposed to that. I've had the opportunity to work with amazing people who never looked at me differently because I was Romanian. I surrounded myself with people whom I could impress this idea on, that it doesn't matter anyway. I mean, Tokyo is so far away from here that, you know, the moment you land, or Seoul in Korea, right? The moment you land there, like, where are you from? Romania? That's like east of something, Africa, Europe, where is it, you know? I mean, listen, it doesn't matter. Ultimately, it doesn't matter. I didn't feel like there was a problem of perception to begin with, or that it had to evolve in some way. When I was working with, I worked a lot with Asians prior to UiPath, so Koreans and Indians. The perception was that there are a lot of technical people in Eastern Europe, more than in Western Europe because of the communist schools, which everyone kind of knows, that there's a higher percentage of engineers, which is true, everyone knows, which by the way is true in Korea also, India also. So, you know, kind of more similar than different, I guess.
What are the biggest missing pieces in the startup value chain? Obviously, the strengths of the ecosystem is obvious, technical skills, engineering pool, it's all there. What's missing, do you think? What are the top couple things that are missing that should be strengthened in the near future?
I mean, if I look down the chain of causality, why aren't things moving faster? It was, and it still is, I have to admit, it still is a little bit blurry for me, but I can tell you what my current assumptions are, or what are the assumptions that I'm trying to validate. I'm working with a number of companies that have, I think, a good amount of success in terms of, you know, reaching a certain ARR threshold, expanding in multiple markets, selling to customer globally, so on and so forth. But I think, or I see, in that we have, and I say we, I include myself, the investor, or kind of the board member, in the same equation with the startups that I work with, we have a hard time defining what a Series A objective set list looks like, right? What a set of objectives looks like for a Series A. It feels like we're chasing down things down multiple tracks without, you know, real focus on maybe the two, three things that, by the way, are, they don't, it doesn't matter if you're in an economical expansion or contraction, ARR is still the North Star. Yeah. You know, the growth rate is still part of that. I mean, you can't tell the story of ARR, annual recurring revenue, without the story of the growth rate, right? Either profitability or free cash flow margin, right? I think second part of that story. And if you think about these as kind of your guiding stars, you realize, hey, that's important in an economic expansion. It's important in an economic recession. And solid venture capital firms will always value solid businesses. And solid businesses look at this stuff, which is, I think, why, you know, in some other parts of Europe, let's not go as far as America, you have higher graduation rates than you have in Romania, definitely higher than in Romania. We're among the lowest, I think. Definitely higher than Bulgaria, or Hungary is almost non-existent in the past 3-4 years, except for one or two examples. But, you know, other places know this. And I've seen, I work a lot with German and with French entrepreneurs and startups, and German, French, Austrian, many of them, and they know this. They know this, and they know how to set objectives for a Series A, and then they know how to set objectives for a Series B, and they take guidance from their investors, and they care less, they put their ego aside, and they work to build great companies, which I know sounds simple, right? Work to build great companies, guys. Build the best goddamn companies you can possibly build. That in itself is a measure of success, independent of the Series A or Series B or whatnot. Sounds easy, but we don't do it. We don't do it. And I see ego getting in the way so, so many times, which you kind of expect, right? It's entrepreneurs, it's people who risk a lot. I mean, there's gonna be some ego in play, but it gets in their way for the most important thing in their lives right now, which is the opportunity to build something great. And that's a shame, and I think that affects our graduation rate. And I think our graduation rate towards Series A is the most significant problem that we have. Before we can talk about number of, before we can talk like the French, like 25 unicorns by 2025, before we get there, let's do 2 Series A per year, okay? Like, I think that's reasonable. What would you say as an investor? Is that reasonable?
It makes a lot of sense. I mean, when I look into the, I'm not native here, I'm not local here, I only come here once a year, but when I look into the Romanian ecosystem, just from a financing perspective, you don't have that many local players. You also don't have many European players looking into the Romanian market, which makes it tough to set those KPIs that would give you a predictable way to a Series A, because it's not a liquid value chain. You don't have tens of players on every single step of the way. And I think Central Eastern Europe is unique in a way that we're trying to find a playbook, a strategy where, if you look into other emerging markets, what I'm trying to say is like Latin America, Southeast Asia, Africa, etc. All of those emerging markets, they have their own regional unicorns. The unicorns from those markets are actually regional. They do expansion into their neighboring countries, etc. Not the case for Central Eastern Europe. Here, the unicorns are global. They go to the US from day one, etc. And that's what makes Central Eastern Europe unique, where you actually have to reinvent the playbook for your own conditions so that you raise your Series A from a UK or a US investor, which is tougher to get. There is no proximity. It's more, much more blurry than being able to raise from your local financing. But you're an angel investor, and I know that you also advise startups a lot. Obviously, you do a lot of mental coaching, founder coaching, building the right mental models, because I can see that that's your strong suit. But what else do you advise them on?
I mean, unfortunately, on crisis situations, for, you know, there's a war going on our borders, and there are companies in Europe that had offices in Ukraine. There are companies, you know, startups I work with that have offices in maybe in Chișinău, in Moldova, that are also asking themselves the question, you know, what if, what do we do? What does a contingency plan look like? There are a lot of startups I work with, and some of them I invested in, that are in the Baltics. And it's not an easy equation there either. So unfortunately, crisis management is still a little bit under the hood of what I do right now. But most of it is around, most of the advising I do is around how to think of your leadership team for the next step, kind of how to project yourself towards the next step. And then in some of the businesses, I can say maybe I have a little bit more skin in the game, because I have a bit of emotional attachment to them. So I spend a bit more time with the founders there. I maybe get a little bit involved in the sales motion itself. One of them is HR Tech. So, you know, I'm a little bit more familiar. They were a supplier for UiPath, something we actually used in our growth stage. So, you know, they're called Smart Dreamers, I can say it. So, you know, I've been working with them the most, I think, since I left UiPath, and I'm enjoying it. And yeah, and there are a handful of others that I support in different capacities. Some more hands-on, some more hands-off. I'm not the kind of guy who will call you up and check up on you every couple of days. That's not what I do. But, you know, I'm one phone call away when you need something. So that's kind of my modus operandi, let's say, my MO with the companies I invested in. And then there's the work I do with venture capital firms. That's also very exciting, because, you know, I work with venture capital firms mainly outside of Romania. So it's, you know, that's how I get my that's where I get my kind of serotonin from, right? Because, you know, I work with companies in Germany, in the Baltics, Austria, France, again, UK, US, that, you know, are rigorously working towards Series A, Series B, some of them to a Series C right now. So, you know, that's kind of helping them think through that, and myself learning along the way with them what they're facing is pretty interesting. And then lastly, there's also, whether it's for startups I invested in or startups VCs I work with invested in, there's the piece about remote work, hybrid work, kind of organizing the workforce. It's a new context. You know, I'm not for anyone who cares to debate this after over a beer. I'm not a promoter of remote work at almost at all, to be honest. It's not something I favor. It's not something I'm an advocate for, and I think 2020 was a disaster on multiple levels for us as humans and as contributors to great companies and great ideas. And I think, you know, of course, the scare of COVID was not the number one reason. The number two reason was that, you know, we thought, hey, remote work and new normal and blah, blah, blah. Whenever I hear new normal again, I feel like my head is going to explode. So yeah, that's another piece. But of course, it is now part of the vocabulary. It is now part of the working habits. So we do have to discuss this, right? At least in the context of hybrid work, like, can you make it work? We did make it work at UiPath, by the way. We were a hybrid work company since before it was UiPath, actually. So, you know, we did make it work, and there are ways to make some stuff work, right? And dare I say, there is even one company I advise that was born remote from day one. It's like it's in their genes, right? But it's also kind of blended in what they do as a business. It just works for them, right? So you kind of have that holy grail of the business model, the philosophy of the team, kind of where it started and what it looks like could encourage towards a remote only model. So as skeptical as I am, you know, maybe I'm wrong. I'll tell you in 5, 6, 7 years if that plays out to be, you know, a deck of corn. And then I'll come back here and I'll tell you, hey, guys, remember 6, 7 years ago when I said it doesn't work? What an idiot I am. It did. So, you know, we'll see. So I'm open to exploring. But that's definitely part of the conversations I have right now.
By the way, I'm definitely on your team where I don't like remote work. I like remote teams working together, but I believe creativity and those sparks happen when you're actually together in the same room. And building a company is not like a straight line function. It's more of a step function. And those steps happens on the sparks of creativity where you actually have to physically be together. But that's just an opinion. We'll see how it plays out. Thanks for joining, and hopefully we'll co-invest soon. To stay in the loop, go to our website, getcc.com, or follow us at getcc on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and YouTube.